Hello, everyone, and welcome to Vessels of Kingsgrave's discussion on episode 3 of the final season of Game of Thrones. This is Nadia, and I'm joined by Shadow Baby.
Hey, it's Hannah in real life.
Jock.
I'm Mando Jock too.
And Gaydon.
Hey, this is Kevin.
Okay, and this is the Wolfcast edition, and this will contain spoilers for all published episodes of Game of Thrones and all published books in the Song of Ice and Fire series. Okay, so just let's get into it. Lemon cake ratings, guys. Gaydon, you want to go first?
Okay, so I gave this a 3.75 out of 5. While watching it, while in the midst of the battle, it's very exciting, very enthralling. Like, I can say without exaggerating, like, my hands were, like, getting really sweaty because I was just so nervous about what was happening. But, there were some things that were nagging at me during the episode that the action allowed me to look over. But once it was all said and done, I kind of felt that there was those problems that I looked over because everything was so exciting. Finally seeing these characters face off against the undead for the first and maybe final time, those problems started becoming really problematic. They started bothering me in ways that we'll get into it as we talk along, but I'm trying to look past it because the episode was really, really good. It like, again, seeing finally having like the Battle of Ice and Fire is amazing and something that we might not ever get in the book. So I do want to appreciate it for its merits. But yeah, there are some big flaws here that bring it down from being something that was exciting as like Hard Home or the Battle of the Blackwater. But yeah, overall, 3.75 lemon cakes out of 5.
Great. And Shadow Baby.
I'm like right with you, Kevin. I was like somewhere between a 3.5 and a 4. But I think, you know, the more I think about it, I think I'll go ahead and give it a solid 4. Although some elements of it are, you know, if we were grading on a curve, would be pulling it the average down a lot. So, but overall, pretty damn good.
And Jock?
I'll give it a 3. Failed in at least. The cinematographer seems to be trying to pull a sort of alien-style horror trick where everything's dark so you can't tell what's the monster, but they didn't build the necessary suspense and lighting to do that. You put it off properly, so that's why it's a 3 out of 5.
I'll still give it a 4 because I'm very determined to enjoy this season no matter what happened. And I also thought like this episode really had some great moments. There were some pacing issues that again we'll get into, but I enjoyed most of it, even though it was dark. I've heard that from everyone who's watched the episode. They were like, it was way too dark.
I feel like that about a lot of stuff in the series though. They tend to overuse like neutral density filters and their color palettes are always like muted and dark. Especially for certain things.
Yeah. So we're just going to cover the episode scene by scene. And we basically start off the episode with everyone just, all the pieces are being set in place, right? Bran's heading to the Godswood. Everyone else is taking their place on the walls. We see Sam being very, very nervous, which as we discussed, seemed a little out of place because in the last episode, he was like, I did kill a White Walker, so I do kind of know what I'm doing. But he's really freaking out in this one. And yeah, we have Tyrion drinking again, because this is the kind of situation where you kind of have to deal with it.
I was drinking.
And we have Sansa and Arya, and the dragons are flying overhead, just keeping a watch on everything. All the armies are stationed outside. And as they're looking out, they see a rider approaching, which turns out to be Melisandre. And she approaches to the Dothraki and she lights their swords on fire, which was a really cool scene.
It was awesome. But I feel like they did that for the effect that happens later when the Dothraki charge out into the open field and you don't see what happens because they're in the fog of war and one by one each Arrak goes out, which was a little disappointing. I thought they were going to do a little bit more, but then they got crushed.
Yeah, as Hannah and I discussed in the lost recording, I think they've done different things. Like, things work differently in the show than they do in the books. In the books, it's very much like as soon as a white is touched by fire, they're basically so dried out that they catch on fire immediately and they start burning. Whereas in the show, fire doesn't really seem to affect them that much. Like, they don't go up in flames.
No.
It doesn't stop them, right? And it's the same with Dragonglass. Dragonglass only stops the White Walkers, but it just shatters when you try to kill a white with it.
It seems like on the show, Dragonglass is what stops them permanently.
Yeah, exactly. Stops all of them. But does it? Like, when the Night King raises them again, they still get back up. It just kind of stops them then.
See, I had assumed that the ones that were getting up were the ones that were killed in battle, and he was refreshing his forces.
Ah, okay. Okay, so we'll discuss that when we get to that.
Yeah.
But we also have, as Hannah pointed out, there are a lot of scenes where Danny and John kind of come together, but they don't say anything. Like, there's kind of like this awkward tension between them, which is presumably because of what John told Danny at the end of the last episode, which is that he's the true heir to the Seven Kingdoms. And it kind of happens, I think, two or three times throughout the episode. And before the battle starts happening, that's when we get the first of those scenes. They're just standing together. They kind of look at each other, but they don't say anything.
Yeah, there's definitely this uncomfortable air surrounding them and just the subject of Danny in general. Like, even in, not to jump ahead, but like in the crypts, there's still talk of Daenerys, the Dragon Queen, and people, Sansa and Tyrion are kind of at odds with how they feel about her. And then Missandei has a snarky remark to them about that. But yeah, the tension between Danny and I was gonna call him Aegon, but I guess you can call him Aegon. It's because he decided on the eve of battle to tell him that, hey, I have a better claim than you. And it's really
bad timing.
It's bad timing because they have this tension between them, and it should not be. It should be focused on the battle that's coming.
Yeah. So anyway, once Melisandre has lit up the Dothraki's sword. Melisandre comes into the castle. She meets Davos, and Melisandre basically tells him that she's going to be dead by the end of the battle. I think she said the same thing last season, like, I'm going to die in this place.
Yeah.
And she told Varys that he was going to die too.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't remember that. Also, Davos doesn't get a line out here either. So yet another, like, unspoken words kind of moment.
Mm-hmm.
He just gets out of her way and doesn't get any words out, which that running theme in this episode I just found was really beautiful and really a great juxtaposition from the last episode, which was, you know, mostly just words.
Mm-hmm. So then we have the Dothraki charging the army that we still can't see, but they can sense, I'm presuming. Anyway, they run towards it. And then suddenly the Arach start going out one by one. And it's. I actually love this scene. Like, nobody can see what's happening. They can just see that, you know, these very scary Dothraki just kind of like, they're just overtaken in a second. And very few of them come back. One of which is Jorah.
Yeah. Visually, it's impressive. Tactically, I'm not quite sure. Again, they charge into the fog of war, and there's really nothing they can see. I'm not sure what they could have done to illuminate the field, but exactly. It was a bad idea.
That's what I kept saying. It's like, why would you charge? Why would you advance at all? Let them come to you. I don't get it.
No.
I have a lot of problem with the logistics in this episode. Like, again, we'll get to that when they light up the trench. But their entire army is stationed outside the perimeter of the fence, like of the trench. Why would you go to all this trouble of of digging a trench and then stand outside it? Why not stand within it and then let that be your first line of defense? Because it is equipped with dragonglass, right? Like, there are shards of dragonglass at the end of the spear.
Yeah, they definitely made all the defenses against the whites. And it just seemed, I have no military knowledge about fighting medieval battles against the creatures of the dead. So I'm not sure if it was... It just seemed like a really bad thing to do on a television show.
You don't have that knowledge?
No.
You didn't go to college? What's wrong with you?
I went to Hogwarts. I don't know how to fight.
That's why. Not a good school. Not in the top five.
Oh, gosh. It's not Ivy League, no.
No, I know. Well, my other thing is, what are those one-time use only trebuchets? Like, I don't get it. Why do you build it and then you only use them once? Like, no.
I think the point is that once the Night King, I think once the Night King gets close and those, like, he brings, like, these very strong winds with ice and, you know, whatever. And I'm presuming it just kind of, like, the same thing happens to the trebuchets that happen to the arrows, the fire arrows. Like, they just go out because they can't stand the wind.
Yeah.
And they're thrown off course.
See, I would have imagined if maybe with the trebuchets throwing flaming debris out into the field and using that to see. Also, maybe asking Bran, could he scout ahead and see where they are, how big, like, what kind of forces they have or how close they are? He kind of was just... I mean, he sends out ravens, yeah, I mean, but he never really reports back.
You can say it. He was useless.
He was useless, yes.
Don't get me started.
And I think everyone's comparing this episode to Helm's Deep. Like, there are so many similarities, but they just don't do it as well as...
No.
It was done, like, that was the most epic battle. Like,
yeah. Quality of filmmaking too, there is no comparison. Helm's Deep was way superior to this. Even Hard Home was better than this episode overall, I think.
Yeah,
definitely.
But comparing it to Helm's Deep, what we're saying about illuminating the enemy, do you all remember that scene where they're all standing on the wall at Helm's Deep and there are, like, lightning flashes, and every time the lightning flashes, you see, like, orcs as far as the eye can go.
That's what I wanted to see. Yeah, I wanted to see, like, maybe some flashes. Like, when they send the trebuchet, the flaming rocks out, like, I wanted to see, like, a really scary image of the hordes of the undead.
Right.
And then maybe after that have the Dothraki charge into it and then just disappear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I thought that there was some failings in keeping the stakes raised. Like, I didn't feel a lot of tension at all because I knew X amount of characters had to survive to keep the stakes high for the next few, you know, three episodes or whatever it is. So I didn't feel any stakes there. And then, yeah, without those visuals, I mean, yes, it is creepy to watch, like, a whole army of Dothraki screamers, an entire horde flame out. Like, that's a nice visual, but it should have been like a foray party, not a full section of their army. It doesn't make any sense.
Not at all.
Why the hell would you do that? Why would you advance on an army you know, like, can barely be defeated?
But then they did have the fire weapons, right? And that should have taken out, like, at least, like, that should have taken out a good number of whites. But
if Brienne and Pod and Jaime can stand with their back against the wall for, like, what ends up being, like, 20 minutes in this episode and survive, then those Dothraki should have lasted a lot longer.
Lord of the Rings, it reminded me of, I think, Return of the King, where I think Denethor sends Faramir out to do that really silly sword, or, like,
Osgiliath.
Yeah, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
But it still wasn't as poignant. It didn't end up being as impactful for me.
No.
Because there's just a lot of logic passed by, and then visuals. You get, like, that one good visual, and then other than that, it's not, I don't know.
It's not worth it. No. But did anybody see Melisandre coming back this episode?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I called that immediately. Well, because
I figured there has
to be, there has to be an Ex Machina there moment for her. I thought that's what they were setting up.
I thought it would be towards maybe the end of the episode or something.
Oh, I wasn't sure when, but I figured at this point in the series for sure.
Yeah, I mean, she had to show up at some point. That's an entire character arc, right? Like, she's the one, R'hllor is the one that stands against the great other, right? So that's, she had to be in this episode.
So I had a theory going into this episode that didn't pan out about her, but I would like to see if something similar plays out in the books. I was thinking it over this week and I thought, okay, Beric is there and Jon is there and both of them have been resurrected by R'hllor. Mm-hmm. So they've been touched by a fire god. And it made me wonder, like, if Beric falls in the battle and, like, can, first of all, can he be raised as a white then, given that he's been kind of kissed by fire, so to speak? And also, if the Night King tried to, would it have some sort of counter effect that would weaken him, maybe?
Yeah.
I never thought of that.
So, I mean, obviously that didn't pan out on the show at all, but I found it to be kind of an interesting question. And I think it will be interesting to see, like, if anything like that does end up, you know, happening in the book.
How would that be, like, significant? Because there are only a couple of characters, like, Beric isn't there in the books. So it doesn't matter.
Well, that's kind of where I thought, like, her role would come in, you know, where she would maybe invoke. And then she does. I mean, so I was like on the right track, because she does invoke R'hllor in this episode. It just wasn't in the way that I kind of expected. I was expecting it to be more of like a counter magic to what the Night King has with his resurrection. That's kind of where I thought it was setting up. So, you know, again, obviously didn't pan out in the show, and at this point probably wouldn't have time, but, you know, it might be an interesting, she's got a role to play in it for sure. So,
yeah, she still has to bring John back, sure.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the way it happens, it'll probably be, like, that's the way it'll happen in the books, but, you know, we don't know that yet.
Yeah, so we'll see, so.
Yeah, okay, so once the Dothraki disappear, the Whites finally attack, and we see all of the major characters, one by one, just joining the fray. And that's when the dragons come into play. They start attacking the Whites, burning large numbers of them, until they hit this kind of wall of icy wind, and they just get lost in it, which I thought was a great way of neutralizing the dragon's power a little bit, balancing it out.
Yeah, because if they could see clearly, this would be a wrap. It would be easy, just Dracarys back and forth until it's all over.
Yeah, exactly. And again, this took me back to Lord of the Rings, where, you know, right before the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, it's all dark and you can't really see it. That's what Sauron does. Like, there's this huge cloud of, I don't know, ash and dust that just kind of blocks out the sun, and it, you know, takes down people's morale and everything. And it just, I kind of compared this to that.
We needed a rousing speech. We needed someone to ride back and forth and just hype everyone up. Like, what is his name? We needed the king who comes to help Gondor on Planar Fields.
Theoden.
Yes, we needed his shields that were shaking. Death. We need. Well, I guess you can't scream death, because then the Night King will be like, someone calling me.
Yeah.
But we need
no speeches.
Life, you know. Okay, yeah, like life, a battle life cry of life. We're gonna live today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but again, I think that's the overall theme of the show. It's all this, the words that aren't said. What can you say?
Yeah, what can you say in the face of death? Like,
yeah, what is there important enough to waste what might be your last, humanity's last, like, hours, you know?
But then that's when you most need a speech, right? To, you know, sort of raise everyone's morale.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I don't mean to skip back, but we didn't really talk about the opening with Sam. And this is one thing I really did not like this episode. Opening right up with him being so nervous after last episode, he's like, well, I'm not going in the crypts. I was the first one to kill a White Walker. Remember, I've got this. I'm going to be a man. And he's, you know, it's like he finally found that courage. And then first thing you do is undercut that. I did not like that at all.
No, well, I didn't like it either. It reminded me of Book Sam when he constantly regresses as a character. But Nadia did mention that when she did her summary. It's really disappointing. I guess we'll get more into it with Sam during this episode. But on the list of characters that should have died, he's like number three. Because he spends pretty much the whole episode blubbering on the floor, surrounded by zombies. You should be dead.
Right. I didn't like how they finally, you know, they gave him, like, I'm going to fight and I have something to fight for. And then you immediately revert him back to a caricature, basically. I feel like it would have been more poignant and more powerful if they had, like, had him walking to his post and being a little nervous and then walk past somebody, like, freaking out and then have him stop and comfort them. Say, like, don't worry, I used to piss myself at every little shadow, but I killed a White Walker and you can too.
Exactly.
That would have been so much better.
Guys, they should just have us write the episodes.
Duh.
We should be consultants, script consultants.
No. Yeah.
At this point, we've earned it.
We are experts with our shocking lack of
knowledge. We are.
Yeah, I just feel like that would have been better and given him more of a full arc, you know. But
mm-hmm. I agree completely. So then in the middle of all the action, we have like this really nice moment between Arya and Sansa where Arya gives Sansa a dragonglass dagger and tells her to stick him with a pointy end, which is a really great throwback to the very first season.
Did anybody say stick him with the pointy end as soon as she handed it to Sansa? Like, I saw that line coming and I was like, yes.
Me too. But you know what? I was like, on the last one, I said, I feel like this is how I felt about Force Awakens. It is a lot of callbacks. They're obvious, but it just feels right.
When it's done sparingly, it's good.
Yeah. And in moments like this, I mean, You would be connecting, and it's all about family for them right now.
And there are a lot of throwbacks in this episode, but I felt like all of them were done really well. Like, they weren't very in your face. Like, I enjoyed those.
Yeah, it was good execution.
Yeah.
So we get more action, and then Bran and Theon are just kind of waiting in the Godswood. And this icy wind cloud thing is just kind of taking over. We see it reaching the Godswood as well. And then everyone's kind of fighting in the middle of it. And that's when we get, I think that's when Ed dies, right? Like, Sam's about to get stabbed and Ed saves him and then he gets stabbed in the back. And I was really, really sad because he's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, he's one of the first, he's the first major death in this episode, I believe.
Yeah, he is.
And that's when my hands started to get sweaty. I was like, holy shit, it's happening. People are dying.
Yeah, this is like the beginning. And then we have Sansa and Tyrion joining everyone else in the crypt. And again, I almost thought this was kind of going to be like back in season two during the Battle of the Blackwater when Cersei and Sansa were waiting with the rest of the women in the Great Hall. And Cersei was just kind of losing it and getting drunk. And Sansa basically consoled everyone else, even though she was, you know, she was very young at the time. And I thought this was kind of going to be similar to that. But this is just, I don't know where, maybe it's because these are northerners and they're kind of like tough anyway. But everyone's just quiet and waiting. Like, there's no panic.
The crypt scenes are probably some of my least favorite scenes of this episode. I feel like, again, we have a Tyrion that doesn't really have much to do this season, but drink and maybe make a few lame japes. And the idea of sticking them down there does make sense, but then we get the scene later on where shit goes down. But I guess I'll say that for later. But sending them down there without guards was a horrible idea.
And again, similarities to Helm's Deep, where, you know, all the women and children wait in the caves.
Oh, yeah. This whole episode's a ripoff.
The enemy's down there with them already. Like, duh. No one saw that coming? Seriously? Like, they should already have those bodies out of there.
But yeah, like I said, there shouldn't be any bodies there other than Ned.
It should be dust.
Yeah, it should be dust. Like, the most recent person buried there is Ned. And he's just bones. And we don't even know if he got there or not. And it was just his bones, right?
But that depends on the embalming process that they're using, because there'd be Rickard and then Rickard's parents.
Rickard and Lyanna and Brandon.
And maybe one more.
Yeah.
Rickard and Lyanna and Brandon are the most recent before Ned.
Because, like, how long does it take a mummified body to decay enough to be raised as a wife?
Are they mummifying them or are they just like burying them?
That's what I'm saying. We don't know like what the embalming process they do use is. it could last several decades.
At the most, then maybe, let's say, 10 Starks come back. It just seems like there's a horde of zombies.
Not a horde, but I mean, yeah, like a good maybe dozen at the most. Aunts, uncles, is it only the main family?
Yeah, I think it's only the Lord and his children. Like,
okay, but still, I mean, each generation, and arguably, I mean, depending on what they're doing, it could be upwards of two or three generations that are still at least skeletal enough to be raised, like intact enough to be raised.
Yeah.
They should have all been armed down there.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, they have plenty of weapons. Like, it's not, it doesn't take much to arm a few women. And anyway, so we get this amazing scene. This one I love. Like, Danny and John are flying through the wind, and they just kind of, because they can't see where they're going, they just crash into each other, and they can't even find their way back. They just keep getting lost.
It's really beautiful seeing the dragons wheel against, like, the cloudy, moonlit sky. I thought that was some of the best, like, cinematography during this episode. Like, that, if we can't see anything else, it was really nice seeing that clear shot of them in the sky together.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so now things are getting...
This is the single most beautiful shot in the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, and it's nice to know that the dragons aren't all powerful. Like, they can't get through everything.
No. Yeah.
There's something that can stop them.
But it did remind me of, like, something that Out of the World book, you know. It was very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the visual effects when they were diving. I thought that the skeletal structures looked spot on, like the movement of the dragons themselves.
I will say those shots, it was definitely worth it losing the other direwolves if more money went to the CGI budget for the dragons. I like Summer. Ghost is cool. I'm glad he got to do something in this battle, kind of, but...
We don't really see him. We only see him for like a second.
He winks at the camera and disappears.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the dragons are like really well done. Although I do have one problem with the dragons. But again, we'll get to that in a future scene. So anyway, things are so bad now that they start to retreat back into the castle. And it's just chaos at this point. Like, everyone's rushing back in. And once most of the forces inside, Grey Worm realizes that this is like kind of their limit. And he orders the trench to be lit. So everyone starts firing arrows at the trench. But the wind is so strong and it's just so icy cold by now that they just fizzle out. And nothing happens. And I thought this is like, again, a pretty cool scene. The scene where the trench is like, or the spears at the gate are coming up.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was. The overhead shot of the Unsullied kind of like doing a lockstep to close ranks and get the survivors inside.
Yeah. This is exactly when they're retreating back into the castle. That's when that happens.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. It's always cool to see, you know, the shields crashing together and just kind of forming a wall.
Yes, it's epic. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't have, like, one of these battle scenes without one of those scenes.
No. It's like classic fantasy stuff.
Yeah. So then we have Melisandre coming out to try and light the trench with, you know, her Lord of Light magic. But in the beginning, it doesn't seem to work. Like, she chants and chants and chants and it doesn't work. And then suddenly the whole trench lights up and it's really, really cool. I am not a fan of Melisandre in general, but in this episode, like, I was waiting for her to do something. I was like, yes, this is why we've been watching you for the last 6 seasons. I was really happy about that.
I was just wondering what she was saying during like the chant. And was it like, if you do this for me, I'll give some change to one of civilians, then the lead god was like, deal.
Light this for me and I'll kill another Baratheon. There's one left. No.
Okay, so this is where we start to see Sandor Clegane like kind of freak out. Like, this is when he runs inside when he sees the trenches lit up, because, you know, he's terrified of fire. And then once the trench is lit, the dragons kind of come back and they, you know, start burning everything that's outside the trench. And again, very cool scene. Like, you know, just seeing all those zombies lit up was really cool. And for a change, we could see something happening on the battlefield.
Yeah, and the House Targaryen theme kicks in, and that's always awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we have a scene in the crypt. And this one I like. This one I enjoyed. Like, Tyrion is, like, he's kind of angry at being sent to the crypt. And he says, you know, I want to be up there. I can fight. I have fought in battles. And Sansa is like, you know, we're more important because of our brains. And if we die, like, we need to stick around for what happens after. And I thought that was cool. That was almost hopeful, like, you know, believing in that there would be something after.
Yeah, I did like that scene between them. It kind of annoyed me just a little bit to have him, Tyrion, feel inadequate. I do think Book Tyrion will be more like, you know what? I don't belong in this battlefield anymore. I've already lost half my face. This being down in the crypts isn't a bad idea. I'm safe here. But then we have Sansa using her brain and comforting him. And then we get the little moment between them acknowledging the fact that they were married and he was, of all her suitors, that's not even the best term to use, of all the people who she's been betrothed to and who have abused yeah. her, he was the best one.
I love that line. You know, he says that's a terrifying thought.
Yeah. And I was thinking, like, she is kind of Sansa Lannister. They are married. So I'm glad they acknowledged that.
Not in the show. They're not still married in the show because she got married to Ramsay Bolton, right?
And they never consummated, right? That's how they got over that.
Yeah, exactly. They just got annulled. Okay, so then we see Theon and Bran in the Godswood. And Theon tells Bran that they've lit the trench. And Bran says, okay, I'm going to go now. And he just goes into the Raven. And then the Ravens don't do anything. Like, they just fly around doing nothing.
What does he even do? What are you doing? Where did you go?
Yeah, what's the point?
Because he brings no information back. I thought this was a recon mission. I thought we were going to get a scene of the Ravens flying over the army of the dead. And we would see giants and maybe even undead mammoths. But nothing happens. This is kind of why I feel like, not to jump ahead, but this is kind of why I feel like Bran is not as good as we would like or we would believe he is. There's something underneath his sweet demeanor, I guess, that I'm kind of worried about.
Yeah, like, we don't know anything about his purpose, what he's doing. Like, he's supposed to be the one to defeat the Night King or take, like, I don't even know if he's supposed to defeat the Night King. I don't know. I don't understand the three-eyed Raven in the show at all.
Because he's kind of just, he just exists with his power and this knowledge, and he is a target for the Night's King, but Sam kind of theorizes that because Bran has all this knowledge from all of history because of his connection to the Weirwoods, that the Night King wants to kill him to, as part of his campaign to end the existence of life, and I forget the exact term they used. So I guess, yeah, that makes sense, but what is Bran's purpose? Why? What is his role in defeating the Night's King? Because he hasn't done anything to do it.
Other than give Arya a dagger. Yeah. Maybe that's how he knew, like, Arya was the one who was supposed to have it. I don't know. Anyway, so then we have, like, when the trench is lit up, at first the whites are stumped. Like, they just stand around doing nothing until the Night King arrives. And then they just kind of start walking into the fire and just, you know, eventually there are so many of them that the rest of them just walk over and they start invading the castle. Like, they break down the gate, they climb up the walls, and that's where my second major problem of the episode is. Why are there so many things hanging off the walls? When you're defending a castle, you keep the walls clear for exactly this reason, so that nobody can climb up. But there are, like, so many things that the whites just climb inside. It's so easy.
It's just not. They just didn't prepare properly for this Siege of the Undead. It's kind of, it's those details that look cool when you watch it, but you know, or rather, if you read the books, like, what they do when a siege is about to happen, how they prepare themselves, and they definitely don't leave themselves open to have the enemy scale the wall.
Yeah, exactly. So again, comparison with Helm's Deep. When the orcs started to, you know, we had these really cool images of them throwing up these really, really long ladders that they then climbed over. And we had like scenes of the soldiers on top of the walls throwing back the ladders. And, you know, there was this whole scene where they were just trying to get something there so that they could climb up. Which is really cool. But here they've kind of like, you know, just, you know, dispensed with that.
I did like how it kind of reminded me of World War Z, where they're kind of just piling on each other to get up the wall too. That was cool. And I did like the visual of them, yeah, like all at the same time, like as a collective falling on the fire to destroy it. It's something really creepy when movies and TV shows do that.
Yeah, it just kind of drives home the point that these things have no free will. Yeah, like they're just dispensable.
Slaves, thralls, yeah.
Exactly. Then we see Viserion come back, right? With the Night King riding Viserion. And that's when Jon kind of takes off and chases after him. And then we have a lot of the main characters just standing on the wall. Not the wall. I keep saying the wall, and that means something different in Game of Thrones. The battlements. Yeah. And lots of fighting. Oh, yeah. This is where we get to see Arya use her cool new weapon, which is really, I thought that was choreographed really well, where she was kind of using the spear and just killing everything inside.
Yeah, and she's kind of like taking it apart to use in close combat. I see now why she wanted a special weapon.
This is really, really cool. Like, I can only imagine the hard work that it took to get this right.
Well, and then I had totally forgotten this, but last night I read an article that was an interview with Maisie Williams where she was like, yep, I made a choice when I was 12 years old and I've been paying for it for 8 years, because she knows that Arya fights with her left hand in the books and she's naturally right-handed, but chose to learn left-handed. And she says it's so hard. Yeah. Wow. Especially now, she's supposed to be badass. Yeah, she thought it would be cool for the fans and is like, I've regretted it ever since.
Yeah, and then we get the other badass little girl. We see this giant white enter the castle, and the only person to take him on is Lyanna Mormont.
Oh, and poor baby Lyanna.
Bad idea.
Yeah, she just kind of gets swatted to the side. And then, we see Sandor Clegane having a panic attack. And Beric is the one to kind of bring him back. He points out that Arya is in trouble and he needs to save her. And again, I thought this was a really cool throwback to the Battle of the Blackwater, where we had the scene between Tyrion and the Hound. And Tyrion tried to bring him back when the Hound was like terrified of the fire, of the wildfire outside the gates. And Tyrion tried to convince him that, you know, we need this. But then he didn't have the emotional attachment with Joffrey or Cersei. And he just went, you know, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. And he just kind of ran away. But here, Beric manages to, like, he kind of gives him the same speech and, you know, manages to bring him back by showing him that Arya's in trouble. And since Sandor Clegane does have kind of an emotional attachment because he did save her at the Red Wedding, that's why he can, you know, kind of, you know, talk himself into it.
Oh, yeah, I think that he loves her very much. And like the immediate snap out of it for him, I found very touching.
Okay, so then we have Lyanna Mormont's death.
Oh my God.
Where fortunately she gets like this really badass moment where she gets to stab a giant white in the eye, but then she gets crushed to death. Which is super sad.
It was, but I have a question. She was in the midst of the battle commanding people, but I thought last season House Mormont only had, 12 guys? Who was she leading?
She could have been...
technically, she is one of the ladies, right?
Yeah.
She's one of the lords of the North.
Yeah, she's a highborn, you know, so it would be befitting her rank.
Well, it could be all the Umbermen, because...
Any like leftover Karstark men. It could be any of the houses, and also her vassals and her, you know, like anything in that area. She could have been doing wildlings, some Night's Watchmen.
It's only in the show that they have 12 men. Like House Mormont doesn't just have 12 men; they have a lot more. Yeah.
I guess my overall thing is, like, this is one bit of fan service I didn't like. It's really awesome seeing her. It's funny. It's cool. She gets to be in the battle, you know, this very young girl. And it's not really conventional, especially in the medieval fantasy setting. But what is she doing there? What Warcraft experience does she have that she should be in the middle of this final battle against the undead? It's kind of, I really wish someone would have, like, put their foot down and said, no, if you want to do something, take your three Mormont men and go to the crypts. You're better off down there.
Well, Jorah did try in the last episode.
Pick her up under your arm and just take her downstairs.
But then she is like their lady, so they can't really do anything. Yeah, she's probably against the law. And to be honest, she's not that young. She's what, 12 or 13, even in the show. And according to their, you know, their world, she's actually not that young.
Yeah, Blam was 8 and he was given in charge of all Winterfell.
Yeah. With the council, though, I just feel like this is, she's inexperienced in this, so this is not really the best place for her. But again, but at the same time, it is a cool moment. I did, you know, feel sad that she died, and I'm glad she got to do something badass like kill a giant.
I love that actress, Bella Ramsey. Hats off, she's so good. I would really like to see. I think it would be neat if she could get cast as a character in one of the spinoffs. Like, I feel the same way about Harry Lloyd. I just feel like she really nailed it, and it'd be nice to see where her career goes from here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not as Lyanna Mormont, but, like, as anyone.
Yeah. So then we see the first few glimpses of the fight between the three dragons, but then it kind of shifts towards Arya, which was a super long scene, and I don't understand why. Like, Arya is just running. Arya suddenly starts to freak out. And she starts running from all the whites, and she just hides and doesn't do anything.
Dude, I could have done without this sequence entirely.
Yeah, I get what they were trying to set up. Like, they were trying to set up, you know, the part where Melisandre comes up to her and reminds her of the prophecy that she had made. But, you know, we could have done with a lot less setup. Like, we just needed like a short scene, maybe, of Arya sacrificing herself.
I watched Game of Thrones this morning. I don't know if you guys ever seen that show. It's like a really funny recap thing that Funny or Die does.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
And he compared it to the Jurassic Park Velociraptor in the kitchen scene. I thought it was really funny.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if they did that scene because it gives them a break from the battle for a little bit. Things get quiet, and instead of the action being so intense, now you have this really suspenseful, tense scene. Because I mean, yeah, my hands were like getting, I was like, oh my god, this is really messing with my nerves here.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I saw the trailer and I saw Arya running terrified, so we see this person who's not afraid of anything, who's killed, you know, all kinds of people, and she's running terrified. And I honestly thought that she would be so terrified because she saw white that had been a person that she had known or she had been close to, right? So I was disappointed that it was just a few random whites.
I thought we were going to see Hodor this episode.
Yeah, honestly, I thought that was one of the disappointing things in this entire episode. Like, we don't see a single person come face to face with a white that they had known when they were alive.
It's not my favorite trope in zombie movies where a person comes face to face with someone they knew before they turned and they can't do it. But I thought that they were doing callbacks this whole episode, so I thought we were going to get Hodor. And then we do see Lyanna Mormont come back as a white, so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We see her like eyes open, I think Ed's too, and mm-hmm. then Unsullied, but I don't think it's Grey Worm.
No, Grey Worm is alive.
Yeah, he's still alive. And we do see Lyanna Mormont rise from the dead, but she doesn't come face to face with anyone.
No.
Yeah. So eventually Arya comes up with the idea to throw a book to distract the whites. And then Beric and the Hound show up to rescue her.
Yeah.
And then Beric dies.
Oh, yeah. He gets stabbed like 100 times. And again, as Hannah pointed out, he tries to say something, but he doesn't get the words out.
Yeah. And then Mel comes.
I'm sorry, I already know what Hannah's going to say because she's already said it once.
No, that's good. Then I don't have to say it.
Yeah. And we also have this, again, we go back to the crypts and everyone can suddenly hear all the whites. And, oh, yeah, this is when they start banging on the doors of the crypts and they scream, you know, open it, let us in. And Sansa just stares and she doesn't do anything.
It's a hard decision,
Yeah, but I think it was the right one.
It is.
Oh,
it
totally definitely is. The right one. That's not a choice she's allowed to make. That's why they're down there with the door locked, period. They knew, they had to have known this was coming. She's not supposed to open the door.
The people up there agreed to, they knew that the only people going down there were a set number of people. Now you're just running from battle because you're afraid. So
right.
I don't blame Sansa for that at all.
Which sucks ass, but it's also why she couldn't let Tyrion out earlier anyway. Like she had to talk him down from that, you know, which I found that scene to be pretty pointless. But this scene right here where she's like, you know, have you ever like heard something far away and been like, what the fuck is that? And then you don't hear it anymore. Something scary. Sophie Turner's acting right there with just what she's doing with her eyes, that searching for sound. Brilliant.
She's an amazing actress. Like the things she can do without even speaking. She's very expressive.
I feel like that is her crown jewel on this series. That really moved me, that I know that feeling, you know, because I live out in the middle of nowhere. So sometimes we do hear like crazy shit like that. Like you'll hear like coyotes attacking something or, you know, and that's what you do. You stand in the dark and you're kind of like searching for sound.
Yeah, and I've heard those animal sounds can sound like people. So I can't relate, but I do. Yeah, I can understand what you mean.
Yeah. So I really felt that was spot on.
Oh, and during the Arya rescue scene, there's another really cool throwback where Sandor just picks Arya up and starts running. And that's kind of a throwback to the Red Wedding.
Yeah. They
rescue her. Yeah. Again, it was nice to see that. And then that's when Beric dies, is when Melisandre shows up and she reminds Arya of, you know, that she had seen that she would kill a lot of people and that she would kill people with green eyes and brown eyes and blue eyes, and I didn't realize how significant this was.
Me neither.
There are, you know, hundreds of thousands of things with blue eyes running around,
including Melisandre.
Yeah.
Somebody said something about green eyes being referring to Cersei.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend about it, and we looked up Lena Headey, her photos, just to be sure. Yep, she has green eyes. And what is her name? Emilia Clarke has green eyes, too.
Doesn't Cersei have green eyes in the books, though, too?
She does.
Yeah.
Also, this is also when we get probably the best throwback of all, where Melisandre says, what do we say to the God of Death? And Arya says, not today. Again, back to the first season. Back in the first season, we had Ciri Forel teaching Arya that.
Okay, so for real, there was a moment here. This was probably the most tense I felt in the whole episode, because I swear to God, she says that and then they exchange this like interesting look and Arya takes like a step toward her, not away from her. And I was like, I swear to God, if she rips her face off and it's Ciri Forel, I'm going to freak the fuck out.
Oh.
I was like, I don't know about any of that right now. And then she took a step back and I was like, oh God, okay.
Yeah.
I would have actually liked that. Interesting.
I just don't know what it would do though. Like it wouldn't make sense. There's no, I don't know. It would be weird.
And then he takes his face off and is Jack and Hagar.
Yeah, right? Like just unzips. It's like a Russian nesting doll in there.
Oh God, that would have been awful.
Yeah, I don't know if that would have worked for this. I would have thought that would have been silly, but it did. It was also a callback to when Mel says, "You know nothing, Jon Snow," to him. And then just real quick on this whole like little arc within arcs with Arya. I did appreciate how, you know, she's been like super badass, fearless robot warrior. But when she gets knocked on the head, she does realize like, oh, fuck, you know, and then kind of has her faith shaken a little bit and then gets it back. Like, I liked that. I felt that was nice. I just could have done without the whole zombie in the library sneak scene. That did not work for me.
Yeah, I agree. And then we have the whites reaching the God's Wood and Theon just kind of preparing everyone. And then we see the Night King attack Winterfell on Viserion. And then we get to the coolest scene, on what I thought was the coolest scene in the episode, which was the dragon fight. I thought this was absolutely beautiful. Although I did have like one problem with it, I couldn't tell the dragons apart. And I think that's an artistic choice that they've made. In the books, we see these very elaborate descriptions of what the dragon eggs are like. And then after they've hatched, that they're these magnificent colors, right? Like Drogon is black and red, Rhaegal is bronze and green, and Viserion is white and gold. But in the show, like, the differences are so subtle. I think Drogon is a little more distinctive than the other two. But in this episode, I don't know if it was dark and it was icy, but I just couldn't tell which one was which unless I could see who was riding the dragon. It was a really cool scene. I just couldn't tell them apart.
I feel like definitely that's been a failing with them from the get-go. Like, even the eggs weren't the right colors, and the colors have never been, like, crazy distinct, I don't think, and I feel like they should be. And the only one that has distinct facial features is Drogon, because we get more of his direct face.
I'm forgiving of it on the show, because I think that lighter colors, like Viserion is, like you said, cream and gold. Rhaegal is a lighter green with bronze somewhere on his scales. But I think CGI, that it would be harder to do. And I think that's why the dragons look so good in this episode, is because it's very dark and it's easier to render darker colors.
We do have one scene where we see Drogon, and we can see, and Drogon is black, right? But we can see like the red highlighted on his horns and the crest of his tail and everything. But with Rhaegal and Viserion, you can't tell anything. Like, you can't tell the colors. I think they spend a lot more money on Drogon than they have on the other two.
I can see some green on Rhaegal. I can
part if like Viserion had his wings spread, he's holes in his wings now. So you can tell that apart.
Yeah.
But it was still hard. And it's just things like that take you out of it, you know?
Uh-huh. But it was a beautiful scene. Like when the dragons are just staring at each other, that was very well done.
It was the Dance of the Dragons. It looked like some of the pictures out of the World Book. They were going to each other's necks.
Exactly, right?
And then that shot of the Night King, like, doing his own version of Dracarys, and Dany has to fly away from the blue flames. The whole thing was really well done.
And then finally, one of the dragons manages to dislodge the Night King off Viserion, and Dany gets another Dracarys moment where she lights up the Night King, but it seems he's immune to the dragon fire, which I don't know why he is, but anyway. Or maybe he can just make things so cold around him that the fire doesn't get to him.
It would have been cooler to see that, though.
Yeah.
Kind of like standing in this ice bubble thing.
Yeah, that didn't make sense at all. Like, why would he be impervious to fire? Then why would it be like he brings the cold, or it gets cold when he comes? Like, obviously, like, why has he been in the north this whole time then? Because he has to gather power to make it cold enough for him to pass. Like, I didn't appreciate that at all.
Maybe he's so cold he burns. Like, you do get freezer burn, and when you get, what do you call it, when you're out in the cold for too long?
Frostbite.
There we go, frostbite. Like, I think Jojen's the one that says it. Like, if ice can burn, love and hate can mate. So maybe he's just so cold he's hot. But I will say, I did not need to see him smiling. That took me out of the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then once the dragon fire fails, Jon starts to run towards the Night King. But he just turns around and he does the snap of his fingers and he raises all the dead people that are around them to stop Jon. and it works. And he just, all these wives kind of take over John, and the Night King just walks away.
Here's my biggest beef with the whole damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are the rules? Because does he have to deliberately raise them? What, like, the whole show, people have been just coming back. Like, a lot of people should have already been raised. I felt like this was so out of order. That should have already been a thing. And then, I don't know. I didn't like this at all.
I think in the show, I kind of figured out what they're trying to do in the show. I think it works like once the Night King has to raise them. And once he's raised them, that kind of gives them like a life. You know, when you're playing a game, you get a life. That's what happens. And then they get killed and they die. And then the Night King has to raise them again, and then they get another life. I think that's how it. I think that's the point. That's how they're doing it.
But is that like a proximity thing? Because we've seen other people raised where the Night King's not around, like the first episode, like Hardhome.
Well, we got the idea that he was close, right?
Last Hearth, I mean.
But I think he was close, right?
We don't really know what, for the books at least, we don't really know what causes them to reanimate, because they were whites already. They had the blue eyes. So their theory is that it was a trap, and that you bring them through the wall and they get reactivated by, who knows, Blood Raven or the Night King, because the Night King is not even in the books. But on the show, I just always assume that he has to raise you back up.
In the books it's very different. You can try to keep killing them. You can cut off their heads and they'd still keep moving. Like, even if there's just one hand, you know, when the very first scene where we see the Wyatts, when they're attacking the Lord Commander, Joe Mormont, even when John cuts off the hand keeps like crawling, trying to get to him. So, you know, it's very different from the book. So we can't compare the two really. That's what I understood from the show, that the Night King has to raise them, and then once they're dead until he raises them again.
See, I would assume that he can only do it once. If they get killed with dragon glass or fire, then there's no way to bring them back. But all theories are valid because we have no clue.
Exactly. We're not told how it works. So anyway, we see a lot of the people who we know, like Ed rises from the dead, Lyanna rises again, but we don't see them come face to face with anyone. So
no.
Yeah. So again, we see just John kind of trying to get to him. And then we see a huge group of White Walkers just walking into Winterfell.
What were they doing this whole time?
Yeah, they were just hanging back, letting the Night King do his thing.
Looking cool.
Yeah. And then we see the Whites breaking out of the crypts and attacking the people taking cover there. And again, it's terrifying. And you know, Sansa, I think it was very realistic that Sansa didn't try to fight back. Like, we didn't get this kind of heroine moment from her. She just runs and hides. I think that was the right choice. Yeah, she had no chance against those Whites.
I mean, if she had gotten grabbed by...
I just don't feel like show Tyrion rude, especially after the whole "I have to do something" like go there on. I feel like he should have died there.
Think he should have done something. I was very disappointed that everyone just seemed to lose their heads down there. I wished maybe Tyrion try to rally people together. Maybe Missandei pick up a knife or something.
Yeah. Well, I do feel like it's sort of realistic that a bunch of people who thought they were safe, dead people coming up would.
I don't think
sort of impatience and wanting to do something, that he'd try something.
I don't think we get to the breaking point. Like, if things had gotten worse and worse and worse, then I think we would have gotten that scene where they try to like fight back. But it just kind of ends before that happens.
And it was these are dead Starks coming back to life, and we have Sansa Stark down there, so I don't need a scene where she comes face to face with the revenant of Lyanna Stark - Targaryen, but I don't know what I'm saying, but like, maybe acknowledge the fact that these are the kings of the North coming back again, and maybe having it be more than just something out of The Walking Dead, because it's kind of just
I'm forgiving.
Yeah, exactly. Like they could have had some emotional weight to it, and it didn't.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I can forgive that for timing. I mean, that'd be a whole can of worms to get into. But yeah, I get. It's, you know, it sticks in your craw though. Like it's just.
I mean, they spent like what 5 minutes with Arya in the library, so I think they could have had just like they don't need much,
right?
Just kind of some indication that it's a Stark and Sansa acknowledging that.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then we get to the scene, which is probably like my favorite scene, which in this episode where Jon is just being, you know, he's just being taken over by the Whites, and Dany comes to rescue him. And for some reason, she doesn't fly away after that. She just sticks around, and all the Whites climb on Drogon. And then Drogon just throws Dany off, and he flies into the air. And then, like a dog shaking off water after you give it a bath, he just kind of shakes off the Whites. And that scene was so beautiful. Like, I don't know if beautiful is the right word, but it was amazing CGI.
I was losing my shit because he was overwhelmed, and you can hear them stabbing him in all different places. So I thought that he was going to try to fly and fall, and that would be it. But yeah, you're right. Like the CGI was really good because like you can see the muscles and underneath his skin, and all the Whites climbing on him.
Yeah, exactly. And then Dany, who's again about to be killed, gets rescued by Jorah, which was so sweet. Like again. Throwback to the first season. Like it's not Jon, it's not anyone else, it's Jorah that comes and rescues her.
Like he always does.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's been there since the very beginning.
I could just hear Dario from the Dance of the Dragons episode, "Protect your queen." I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. And then the scene that I think both Hannah and I really like, we found it very touching, where John just starts running towards the Godswood, and he passes Sam, who's screaming for help, and he has to make a choice between Sam and saving Bran and the rest of the world. And he just kind of like, he looks back at Sam, and then he just keeps running. And it was touching.
The right choice.
It was the right choice, yeah. And then we see Theon having his badass moment where he takes down a lot of dead things, and until the Night King gets there. And then we have Jorah and Dany just hanging around. Dany manages to get a sword, and she kind of helps. Jorah's protecting her, but then she's also protecting him.
There was one weird shot in there where I swear to God, it looks like she's using him as a human shield, and he gets stabbed. Like she throws him in front of her.
I think that's what it looked like, but I think he is the one pushing her behind him.
I watched it a couple times, and that's what it looks like. It didn't look good. I would have not
maybe done it a little differently. Yeah, and then we go back, flashback to the crypts where the Whites are kind of taking over, and we have again this touching scene between Tyrion and Sansa, where Tyrion just kisses her hand, and they're like, when she pulls out the dagger, and they're just like, yeah, this is it. And I think Sansa was about to reach the point where she might fight back.
Yeah, if like one of them had grabbed her or something, like you got to do something.
Yeah, exactly. Again, Jon is just going crazy trying to get to the Godswood, and then suddenly Viserion shows up. Even though his throat has been ripped out, and I thought that was really cool, like they did the whole light pouring out of his wounds kind of thing, where, you know, so it kind of shows where he's been hurt, which I thought was cool. And then things kind of slow down for a second when the Night King gets to the Godswood, and Tyrion and Bran have this really touching scene where Bran tells him, where Theon apologizes, and then Bran tells him that everything you did brought you back home. And I thought that was a really nice way to give Theon some closure.
Yeah, I think it's time for Theon to die now. He's been technically dead for quite some time. Bran knows it, Theon knows it, and it's kind of just, now I'm not, Theon's saying to himself, now I'm not going to run from protecting someone, from saving someone. I'm going to run to defend them, and that's how he goes.
Yeah. I thought this was, again, Theon's attack on the Night King was done pretty well, where, you know, he has a dragon glass weapon and he rushes at the Night King, but the Night King just kind of grabs the shaft and snaps it off, so the dragon glass can't touch him. And I thought that was really cool. Like, it's done very quickly, but I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
And he stabs him with, like, the broken shaft, right? He doesn't take out his own sword.
No, yeah, he stabs him with the shaft, and I thought that was rough.
Yeah.
I don't like Theon, but that was really bad.
Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed Theon's arc overall, like in the books and in the show.
Okay, yeah, let me separate the two. I don't like Theon in the books just yet, but the show Theon, I really do. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate
it. Not even after the dragon, the Dance of the Dragon chapters, like, you know, the Ghost in Winterfell. And mm-mm. I thought those chapters, like, do a really good job of making Theon seem more like a Stark, where he finds refuge in the Godswood.
I read them all back to back, so Clash of Kings was still fresh in my mind. I think maybe it works better if you have a little bit of delay between the books. I don't know. But I guess personally, just remembering all the things that he did, I'm not happy that Ramsay's torturing him in that way. I don't appreciate it. It doesn't make me feel better, but I would be happy if someone lopped his head right off. But show Theon is awesome.
No. Okay, so we have four of Jon running towards Bran and not getting to him. It's just, I think the last 20 minutes of this episode, I was just waiting for Jon to get to the Godswood, and we keep seeing him running and running and running, but he's not getting anywhere. And I was like, when is he going to get there and kill the Night King?
I don't know if people will get the reference or not. I feel like Jon is playing Skyrim this whole time, because he's stuck in this boss battle with Viserion, and like all these mini enemies are surrounding him. He's killing the whites, but every time he tries to go down a different hallway, there's a blast of dragon fire from Viserion, and he just can't make mm-hmm. it. So he has to fight the boss dragon before he goes. I just thought it was funny. Like, he's stuck in a video game.
Yeah. And then the Night King gets to Bran, and just as he is about to kill him, I presume, he's reaching for his sword, and he's about to pull it out. And at the same time, Jon comes face to face with Viserion, and they both start to scream. And this is the point where I'm like, yo, yeah, Bran is dead. Like, Jon is nowhere near the Godswood, and Bran's going to die. And then suddenly we see Arya jumping on the Night King. And then he grabs her throat, and I was sure that she was dead. Because I've been convinced this entire time that Arya was most definitely going to die.
Yeah, I was pretty much screaming my head off, like, no, he's going to snap her neck. Oh.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought was about to happen. Because I've been so sure ever since, like, the very first book where Jon has this dream about Arya being lying frozen in the snow, holding needle. Mm-hmm. So I've been convinced that Arya would die sometime during the battle with the others, right? So I was sure that this is it. But then the knife drops and she catches it with the other hand and he stabs him in the heart and it's done.
Yes. And that's when my no turns into a yes.
Yeah, cheering. Like, I don't generally like shout and cheer and during, you know, when I'm watching a TV show, but this is like, yes.
Yeah. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was yelling my head off. It was awesome.
Yeah, that little move was pretty original, too. I really liked that. But what the fuck is the point of Bran? I do not get what the point of him is now. I don't understand why he was not involved in, like, anything.
Mm-hmm. He stared at a lot of people.
Yeah, what the fuck is the point of that?
My only belief is that we're not done with the Whites or the Night's King, or we're not done with that. The story of the undead. We have three more episodes to go, and I think they're all pretty long. So the moment with Arya and the Night's King was awesome, but it just felt like there's more left. So, and again, I feel like Bran is maybe not hiding something, but there's something sinister beneath that. I just something.
Yeah, maybe we get something. I think the Night King is pretty much done. Like, he explodes, or the White Walkers explode, the Whites just fall dead. So I think whatever happens might come from Bran. And we don't know what that might be.
Well, he just got Theon killed.
He could have told him, like, in 5 minutes, Arya's going to kill the Night King. You don't have to do this.
Yeah.
So useless to me. Like, what the fuck? Mm. I just don't get him at all.
Maybe he's more human than we think. He's just having memories back to when Theon burned over his stuff.
I mean, I don't blame him.
It's like, you're a good man, psych.
So again, with the Lord of the Ring references, this was again something similar to what happens in Lord of the Rings, right? Where you destroy, as soon as you destroy the ring, that destroys Sauron, which in turn... it didn't exactly destroy his armies, but they just kind of fell back after that, right? And it's an even more extreme case of that, where, you know, they just, you kill one person and you've basically defeated the entire army. And I generally don't really enjoy that. Like, I think it's too easy of a solution.
It's a fantasy trope. Like, you kill the... Like, I was going to say, you kill the master vampire, you kill all the vampires. Like, it happened in the Avengers, the first movie. Not Endgame. I'm not going to spoil that for anybody. But you kill... Tony Ultron? Kills the ship. Huh?
It happens in Age of Ultron too, right?
I
can't remember that.
I think they killed each individual thing because they had to, unless Ultron... If one piece of Ultron survived, then...
I
can't remember. But I do know in the first one, they killed the ship and the Chitauri died. But I'm not a fan of it either.
Yeah, exactly.
It's too easy.
Again, comparing it to Lord of the Rings. In the Lord of the Rings books, it doesn't happen that way. Even after Sauron has been destroyed, his armies still stick around. Like, they're a problem for a long time for both Aragorn and Eomer. But in the movie, I think they did more of that when Aragorn and his entire army, they basically get surrounded by Sauron's forces. And as soon as the ring is destroyed, basically the land just falls away. Like, everyone gets buried,
mm-hmm.
all the orcs. I thought the movies did that. And they've done like an even more extreme version of that here.
It's just a neat way of tidying up the story. It's...
Yeah, exactly. You know, ending it quickly.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for Martin, but he talks about this in Lord of the Rings. Like, after everything was over, did Aragorn and company chase down each individual orc and kill them? Because did they wage genocide on the orcs? Because, you know, they're orc families. So in his book, he would have handled, in his version, he's going to handle it differently.
Definitely.
I feel like the others aren't sympathetic creatures at all. So
I think it's going to be very different in the books because... the Night King is only a figure in the show, right? The Night King in the books is a very different character. Like, he's a historic character that was there thousands of years ago, who was a Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, who took a white as a wife and did some unspeakable things that nobody knows about. So he doesn't exist anymore, right? So we've only seen White Walkers. We don't know anything about their hierarchy or anything. So I think it's going to be very different in the books.
Definitely. And like, maybe even the Night's King, as he calls it, doesn't even exist. Who knows? But yeah, it's going to be definitely different.
Uh-huh. And okay, so then after the Night King is destroyed, finally, we see Jorah dying. And again, we get one of those scenes where he almost says something but doesn't get anything out. And we just have Dany grieving. And then Drogon, in a very touching scene, just kind of comes and just kind of wraps around the two of them.
He tries to give her a hug, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you have to understand that Jorah has been there for all of Drogon's life as well. So, I mean, Drogon must be feeling some emotion too, right?
That's true, yeah. I never thought about that, yeah.
I just thought of that myself.
He was there when he was born.
Yeah, exactly. And then we just kind of get like flashes of all the characters who've managed to survive. And then we see Melisandre walk out of the castle and she walks through all of the corpses and she takes off her necklace, becomes old and just falls down dead. And it was nice to see. It was a nice scene to see, because, you know, this person who is, we don't even know how many hundreds of years old, and this has been her entire purpose, to defeat the Night King. And she's finally seen it achieved, and now she can finally rest.
Yes. She made mistakes during the course of her quest to do this. And so
many mistakes.
It's really hard for her to, like, revel in this victory. So I can understand her just, I got to die now. I mean, I did my thing, but I've done a lot of damage at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's it. That's the end of The Long Night.
I was so relieved when the credits came on. I was like, I can finally breathe normally.
Yeah. This is a long, long episode.
Yeah, when I saw it was an hour and 30 minutes, I was like, this is going to be a real test. But it was a really good episode.
It was a good episode. As many nitpicks as we've, you know, kind of pointed out, I still really enjoyed the episode. I thought this was a good one.
One final nitpick then. I'm kind of very, very, very tired of there being shots of... I feel like it's not a final battle with John if he's not stuck somewhere and someone swoops in to save him. It's so overdone. I mean, it's still epic and cool at the same time, but it's just, But I did think one final thing, but I thought when John was facing off with the Night King before he got the Army of the Dead up, I kind of expected during this final battle for him to finally take his sword out and do what Beric does. Maybe not even knowingly, it just happens and his sword turns on fire.
Uh-huh. That would have been cool to see.
Yeah,
He has Valyrian steel, so it doesn't need to light up. They're like, the fire is in the steel.
That's true, but I feel like John, he has to have all the plot gifts. He can't just ride a dragon. He has to ride a dragon with a Valyrian steel sword that's on fire.
Get to the Night King.
No, and fail, yeah.
Yeah. When we discussed the last episode, I think it was Hannah who came up with this idea that this might just be a feint from the Night King. Like, he's going to send some of his army to Winterfell, and then he's going to head south to King's Landing, because that's the center of power. And so then, you know, it might kind of wake up Cersei to the real threat, right? And I like that idea. Like, it wasn't just going to end in one big battle. There were going to be like a number of smaller ones, and then that might eventually bring the Lannisters on the same side as the Targaryens and the Starks, right? But yeah, obviously we're not getting that.
No, it's the Night King got killed.
No, I think I Cersei. The same...
No, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying. I think Cersei is like the main villain of the season, not the Night King.
And that's sort of disappointing because, well, at least in the books, we were always told, like, the Iron Throne wasn't the true story. That's not what everyone should be worried about. That's kind of like the distraction. What the true threat is the Army of the Dead.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I hope that the War for the Dawn is the climax of the books and not the way it is here, because I don't see how anything supersedes that.
No. But I do hold on to the hope that we're not done, that there's still something left that has to happen. But who knows?
Yeah. Also, with the whole Arya killing the Night King thing, in the past seasons of the show, we've heard about Azor Ahai, we've heard about the prince that was promised. So was that just complete bullshit? Like, there's no prince that was promised, at least in the show. I mean, I'm not talking about the books, but in the show, like, they've just gone in a completely different direction. Do you think that's because Arya is such a fan favorite that they had her kill the Night King and just ignored all the prophecy that's been set up for the end of the Long Night?
Definitely. Kind of their MO.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Because she's such a popular character, they need to have her do this.
I wasn't expecting it, so.
Yeah. It is kind of a nice twist at the end, but there was a lot of setup for, you know, there being this prophesized hero. I don't mind there not being one. I'm just, you know, I'm wondering if that was what they were thinking.
Well, I guess you can twist it to fit anyone. Sure, I can figure out a way to make it for Arya.
Yeah, probably could.
The smoke could be Winterfell burning and the salt could be Blavos.
Yeah, but then she wasn't there when Winterfell was burning, right?
Well, it's still her home.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, the fire at, what's it, the place where the Night's Watch got attacked by the Lannister men. The barn. She had just
sneaked
out of the escape passage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you could like twist it around to fit anyone's story. Like salt and smoke aren't exactly, you know, very difficult to find.
Secretly, it's a solving process that defeats the White Walkers.
Somebody was saying that the prince that was promised fits John because how Lyanna's like, promise me, Ned.
That fits. There's also someone, I can't remember the exact line, but during, I think, the Dothraki horse eating ritual in the first book, Jorah tells, he uses the prince that was promised when talking about Rhaego. I feel like it comes up in so many different ways that you can really apply it to so many different people. And it might just end up being many different people.
I think in the books, there are like two main characters that kind of fulfill the prophecy, and those are Jon and Daenerys. Because also the thing is that the princess and the prince that was promised is going to be from the line of Aerys and Rhaella, and Dany and Jon are the only two ones left alive. And
yeah, but that's what they are saying. That.
Yeah, true.
And on the show, they have Lanley's the Beauty Stannis, which was salt and smoke. Are you a ham?
Is he a ham? Yeah, I like that.
So thank you all for joining us. If you want to find us, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can always find us on our website, vokpodcast.wordpress.com. And if you want to discuss any of this with us, please join the forums at podcastofficeandfire.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Nadia.